Thank you for listening to this podcast that is part of a series dedicated to the 14th edition of FONS event. The theme of this year's event is High Reward, High Risk. My name is Marije Groen, and in today's episode, the words disruption and innovation are among the most popular in today's business and investment literature. Looking up these terms in Google's academic search engine Scholar results in over 17,000 publications since 2020. Yet real innovations and disruptions, the ones that fundamentally change the competitive conditions and landscape of an industry, are rare and hard to find. And it's even harder to identify companies that can implement the right business strategy to maintain or gain a sustainable competitive advantage. My guest today is Raj Chand, Managing Director and Portfolio Specialist at Jennison Associates, a fully owned subsidiary of PGIM. Raj has a clear understanding of disruptive innovation and its impact, and he knows how to best apply this knowledge in his investment portfolio. Welcome back, Raj. It's so good to have you again.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Raj, McKinsey research concludes that we currently live in a disruptive world. Would you agree with that? And if so, why?
Well, the short answer to that is that I would agree. Yes, absolutely. And the long answer is the why.
So, tell me.
I think it's important to go back to the beginning. And the beginning really goes back to Moore's Law, which at its simplest says that every 2 years, the number of transistors on a microchip doubles. So every 2 years, you could either think that the computing power in the world doubles or that the cost of computing halves. And so when you think about disruption and innovation, each wave of technological disruption and innovation builds on the previous one. So if you think of the big waves we've had, the PCs and the desktop computers, you know, that was the whole of the 80s and the 90s really sort of fanning out across everybody's desks at work and at home. The mobile phones really only began in the 90s and were prevalent throughout the noughties. The World Wide Web was probably about the same time, the 90s and the noughties. The smartphones really combined those two things, the mobile phone and the internet, and really caused another wave of disruption starting from the end of the noughties right through to the present time. And the 5G technology may unleash another wave of disruption when that kicks in. And then cloud computing. Another concept like the smartphone that may date back quite a long way, but really only began in the noughties. And the disruption there is really only just beginning in the earliest stages. So for sure, we live in an age of disruption.
Right, right. And look at how many of those we've already experienced in the years that we exist on this world, right?
Absolutely.
Now, Clayton M. Christensen, the inventor of the disruptive innovation theory, stresses that it is important for business leaders, for decision makers and stakeholders to get innovative disruptions right. Would you agree with that? And also, what is the definition of a disruptive innovation?
Yeah, I mean, again, there's a short and a long answer to this. So the short answer is, you know, disruptive innovations by their very nature are absolutely crucial for the future of a company, the future of a whole industries in many cases. And of course, it's really important to get them right. But the most famous book that Christensen wrote was called The Innovator's Dilemma. And that basically says, you know, it's very hard for existing companies in an industry who are used to doing things in a certain way, big business generating lots of revenues from the old way of doing things, to get the innovation right, to back it properly. So, you know, you could think about light bulbs to LEDs. LEDs, practically speaking, last forever. And so a lot of light bulb companies understood the technology, but they didn't want it.
No.
Because it killed that replacement cycle they were so used to. Right now, today, every one of our listeners can see this in action because of the streaming. So linear TV is dying. Traditional movie going and theatre going is dying. It will always persist to some extent, but in a much smaller form in the years to come. But a company like Netflix that doesn't have existing movies and doesn't have existing channels finds it much easier to invest 100% of its budget and get 100% of its people behind the streaming model. If you're any one of a number of other companies, whether it be Disney, whether it be Peacock, you know, and CNBC, for them, it's a really big decision because they're allocating resources from very profitable businesses that are already, you know, contributing lots of cash flow to the company to try and allocate to an upstart business. And internally at the board meeting, there's a lot of dissent. So Christensen both understood the importance of getting these innovative disruptions right for companies, but also he wrote at length about the difficulties, the practical human difficulties for existing companies to adapt to those new innovations.
Right, right. So if I understand this correctly, and if I can summarize what you just said, disruptive innovation occurs when a company sells a new product or a new service to a previously unserved or non-existing customer segment with different needs. And those needs are then managed in a new and a smarter way using a different business model altogether that makes the previous business model obsolete, if I understand correctly.
That's a great summary. I think I should draw that distinction that an innovation is a new way of doing things. And disruptive innovation is a new way of doing things for which we had an older way that was either offered people less convenience, less choice, or less value. And so disruptive innovations generally combine those three features. And that's why they destroy the model that went before for a newer, better model. Well, better if you're the consumer, not if you're one of the legacy companies
exactly.
that gets destroyed.
Very, very clear. What then, Raj, is the relation between secular growth and disruptive innovation?
I think that's a great question, probably a much more nuanced and difficult question to convey, because not all disruption and not all innovation leads to secular growth. So, you know, if you think about open source coding on the internet versus the iOS from Apple, you know, they're both innovations, but only one has led to a very profitable business model and the other, by definition, was diffused to everyone. So not every innovation, not every disruptive innovation will lead to secular growth. And so, you know, for a company to turn its disruptive innovation into secular growth, it must have means, mechanisms by which it can harness and grow that market and keep competitors out. So that may be technological innovation that future competitors or potential competitors don't have. It may be economies of scale. So once you get to a certain size, other people simply can't come in. It may be network effects, which is a very similar idea. But the more people that are on a platform, the more people want to come onto that platform rather than some new upstart. Or it could be as simple as a patent or some other form of legal protection. But you've got to have something, because in a world where growth is relatively scarce, long duration secular growth of a significant magnitude is incredibly attractive. So everybody wants in, right? So you know, for investors, it's crucial to look at what's going to keep those other people out to allow that secular growth over a multi-year period.
Right, right, right. You mentioned already technology and digitalization in your introduction. What is the exact role? Because I think that those are really the drivers, right, of disruptive innovation. Can we say that?
Yes, I think we can. Although the forms in which it gets adopted into the real economy, into different companies, vary dramatically from sector to sector. So technology and digitalization have allowed us to look at things in a completely different way, whether we're talking about the smartphone and the mobile internet. And indeed, I was saying earlier, you know, the rollout of 5G networks will allow smartphones to do things that really were unthinkable up until now. And the Internet of Things, so all of these ways of interacting. And digitalization is representing the real world with zeros and ones. It sounds surreal, but it allows ever more difficult concepts to be digitalized and manipulated and explored in different ways. So whether you think about CAD/CAM technology, about designing new companies, new vehicles, or whether you're thinking about designing new molecules and new vaccines and new pharmaceutical treatments, digitization allows the manipulation of really complex data and very large amounts of it very quickly and very easily. So at the heart of a lot of waves of innovation, be they in more familiar areas like fintech and entertainment, or be they in things like product design and pharmaceuticals and healthcare, really technology and digitization is at the heart of those.
Right. And do demographics play a role as well? I can imagine. What kind of role do they play?
I think demographics are very important because whether we like it or not, you know, after a certain age, we become less receptive to change. Mm-hmm. And so one reason why disruption is accelerating is because of the rise of the millennials. They grew up as digital natives. They grew up with this digital technology. They get the concept that your apps may not be sitting on your phone or on your computer, but off in the cloud. And they, you know, so they think and work in different ways. They're very receptive to new ways of communicating, shopping, working, being entertained. And so the rise of millennials allows new ideas and new innovations and disruptions, an audience, a receptive audience for mass adoption. Hmm. That mass adoption allows economies of scale, which allows a cost to fall, which then allows these innovations to become ubiquitous. So, you know, demographics plays a part in that. And the millennials are probably the key generation, the first digitally native generation in the population.
And how do you then find the companies that those millennials will actually make use of that are interesting for your investment portfolio?
Well, you know, that's a great question because I think a lot of investors think that they've got to find those companies. And we would actually argue that that's wrong. That's a wrong way to think about this, these tremendous forces of innovation and disruption. Because, you know, I'm in my 50s now. Many of our sector analysts at Genesis and Associates are sort of not the millennial generation. Let's put it politely that way.
Right.
And so if people sit in investment centers around the world, middle-aged people who, relatively speaking, maybe relatively affluent, and they think they've got to work out what the next big thing is for millennials.
It doesn't work that way.
It's a terrible idea. So what we say is actually the opposite. Let the technological innovation find you. Hmm. So how do you do that? That's the issue at hand. So the way to do that is to get raw data and find out what it is. What apps are people downloading onto their phones? Are there new apps being downloaded onto phones that you've not heard of, that are really sort of, you know, under the radar now, but on that exponential curve? Are there new functionalities? Are there new cloud software services that companies are voting with their budgets, with their dollars, to coalesce around, to bring into their companies? So what we look for is things like market share breakout. We look for inflection point in company earnings. And that tells us that the people that count, i.e. the customers, the clients, the people paying for things with their dollars, the people downloading apps onto their smartphones, valuable real estate, that screen on your smartphone, those people are coalescing around something interesting, something new. And that something interesting, something new is breaking away from the pack.
Yeah.
That's the best way to do it. Not sit around as a 52-year-old
trying
saying,
to determine
what will kids like in 2022, 2023?
Because you
Terrible
cannot.
Idea.
No, you cannot no. anymore. No. I wonder, Raj, can a culture also be innovative? Or maybe to say, what is the role of culture in innovation?
Yes. I mean, I think culture is that qualitative, hard to quantify, but crucial ingredient in an innovation, innovation history, innovation track record. And, you know, I think creating an environment where it's okay to try great things and fail is really difficult for companies, right? Because the senior managers in companies always feel under pressure for the next quarter and the next year, whereas some of these innovations may not pay off for a couple of years into the future. But actually, you know, that culture is crucially important because investors, you know, if you're thinking about your retirement and your pension in the future or saving up for your children, you've got to take a multi-year perspective. Mm. And most great disruptive innovations, most great innovative companies, you know, they're not just innovations in themselves. They're a series of innovations built upon one another. Mm-hmm. So if you think about Amazon, how interesting would that be as an investment if all it still did was selling books online?
Yeah.
I mean, it would have stopped being a good investment many, many years ago.
Yeah.
It's building innovation upon innovation. And, you know, the latest leg of innovation and growth has come from cloud computing, AWS.
Yeah.
But, you know, at the beginning of Amazon, that wasn't even a concept. That wasn't even a thing. So the culture has to be, and Jeff Bezos has written about it amongst others, it has to be to invest for the long term. Mm-hmm. It has to be to try things. And of course, some of those things will fail. If the senior managers of that company shoot the leaders of that project that failed, nobody else is going to try anything.
No.
So, you know, it's a very difficult thing to pin down.
Yeah.
And that's why, you know, at Jennison Associates, we encourage our fundamental analysts to constantly stay close to companies, to meet people at different levels of those companies, so they can gauge this intangible thing called culture. Mm-hmm. Because it is so important for the long-term investment and long-term innovation, which is crucial for long-term returns in the shares of that company.
Yeah, and I can imagine then governments play a role as well, right? Different countries are being steered in different ways, no?
Yes and no. I would say that, you know, so I'm based in London. Mm-hmm. A lot of my colleagues are based in the US. And I would say that the notion that governments have a big part to play in innovation is more of a European notion.
Okay.
And the reason why entrepreneurs from Europe and Asia all want to go to Silicon Valley is because in Silicon Valley, they feel like governments have a part to play in terms of general education, you know, a framework, rule of law, those kind of things. And then the biggest role they can play is to get out the way.
Okay.
And let people get on with it. And I think in Europe, the reason why a lot of entrepreneurs choose to take really innovative companies over to the US is because governments feel like they know better. And they don't, right? They're mostly middle-aged and in most
Again.
Countries, mostly men. And they're trying to decide what people will want in 3 to 5 years' time. And it's a long way from the profit motive that's driving Silicon Valley from one innovation to another. And so, yes, governments must play a part in education, rule of law, and those kind of basics. But after that, innovation is really, you know, about the human spirit, human ingenuity, and that knows no bounds. But if middle-aged technocrats and bureaucrats start to get involved, you just won't get the level of innovation you could do with exactly those same people in a freer environment.
I think you very well made that point clear. What would you say makes an industry sensitive to disruption? And could you perhaps give us an example of that?
Sure. I think, you know, the key classic characteristics of industries that are vulnerable to massive disruptive innovation are high profit margins, a long time of not innovating, not adopting new technologies, not being receptive to new practices. And so sort of essentially being backward facing, but having the luxury of doing that with big fat profit margins. So if you look at the global financial sector, makes a lot of money, right? Even now, you know, we're a long way into technological innovation and fintech, but it makes a lot of money. What do banks fundamentally do? They take your money and mine, and they might move it from point A to point B, often very slowly, and then charges a lot of money for that as well. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, if you add to that, you know, in certain parts of the world, in many parts of the world, it's even very difficult to get that bank account, to get into the banking system, and to, you know, get any lending, to get any money transfer. So when you look at that sector, you see a massive profit pool, And we look at disruptive, innovative fintech companies, and some of them start out not even intending to disrupt these big, fat, lazy, inefficient banks. But, you know, if you look at something like Alipay, Alibaba started that because so many people on its e-commerce platform didn't have a bank account.
Right.
They wanted to make it easy for people and make both parties able to trust each other. You know, Mercado Libre, the leader in e-commerce in Latin America, followed the same model with a payment system. And then Shopee, which is owned by Sea in Singapore, is a leader in Southeast Asian e-commerce, doing the same kind of thing.
Yeah.
And what each of them has found is that they are offering people something that's cheap, it's fast, it's convenient. And for a lot of people, there isn't even any competition because Chinese banks, Latin American banks, Southeast Asian banks wouldn't even have them as customers. They couldn't even get a bank account.
Yeah.
Now, if that industry isn't ripe for disruptive innovation, you know, you'll never find a better one.
Yeah.
So it's a huge profit pool. And what people are doing is they're finding something cheaper, better, more convenient, more flexible, and, you know, actually very accessible.
Yeah.
And so, you know, these platforms, these payments platforms are growing very rapidly because the competition is just so awful. And, you know, that's the definition of an industry that's ripe for that.
Yeah. And I think these new systems, they don't have all the legacy systems and processes. They don't have all the regulatory issues that banks are dealing with. So they can really start a new business that is far more efficient in so many ways. Yeah.
I think you're spot on. So when you think of a famous bank in your country, you know, quite often that will have grown over the decades through acquisitions, and every acquisition brought a different mainframe system, different servers. And they're terrified of trying to integrate all of that because, you know, if that system goes down, you know, that's disastrous.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
Very bad publicity.
Yeah.
So many big banks in many countries will have not just two or three, will have 7, 8, 9 different technology platforms. So every time they invest 100 euros, you know, that's spread over all those different systems. A new company with a new platform, with a single platform, every $100 they spend is just on all going into that platform.
Yeah,
so it's a huge advantage, even though they're much smaller than those
indeed.
Big beasts that they're competing with.
A very, very big difference there, indeed. What would you say, Raj, is it that companies need in order to thrive in a disruptive environment?
I think there's two elements. There's the actual disruptive innovators. And that's, you know, that's really that culture of innovation, that willingness to try something that may be a better offering for the consumer, to think differently about old ways of doing things. But then there's all those other companies, and they're far greater by number, by market cap in stock markets, by profits at the moment, across sectors from retail and finance and, you know, all these other sectors of the economy, where the leadership teams have to be receptive to change, to the possibilities that new technology may affect them. Now, how many of us have come across very senior people who just refuse to understand or accept that the world is changing?
Yeah.
They're unwilling to rethink old ways of doing things. It's only by embracing those new ideas, adapting quickly, that you can really get ahead of the competition, stay current, stay up to date, stay relevant for the future. And at this point, you know, I'd like to emphasize that point with a quote from Charles Darwin, which I love, because it really summarizes, you know, the issue at hand for companies that aren't in the technology space, but, you know, are inevitably being affected by new technologies. And I think the Charles Darwin quote, I'll probably not get it exactly right, but it's something like, it's not the most intelligent or the strongest animals that survive. It's those that are most adaptable to changes in their environment. And so survival
sounds about right to me. I recognize the...
Yeah.
I think you got it right. Yeah.
Well, survival of the fittest is often deemed to be, you know, who's the strongest. Well, once upon a time, IBM was the strongest, but it wasn't the fittest because it wasn't the most versatile, the
adaptable.
Most adaptable to change. And I think that's the way that investors have to think, is which companies in retail, which companies in finance, which companies in healthcare are thinking about how they can utilize these new technologies to not just stay relevant, but to get ahead of the curve and innovate for themselves.
Right. And for your strategy, do you have a process in place to research the adaptabilities of companies? And if so, how do you measure that?
That's a great question. And, you know, so at Jensen Associates, we were founded in 1969. So, you know, we've got over five decades of experience as a growth equity investment house. So, you know, we're looking for change, looking for innovation, looking for those companies that can innovate and generate secular growth for themselves over the long term is part of our DNA. And we've always believed that really you've got to do that through proprietary research. So we have a team of growth analysts who don't look for any other kind of equity, not income, not value, nothing else, only growth equities. On average, they've got over two decades experience in their sectors. Mm-hmm. And all they do is every day they come into the office and say, in my space, who are the real great winners? Who are the great growers? And what are the dynamics that are making them grow? And who will be tomorrow's great growers? Who's really in the sweet spot of these dynamics of change and innovation? And that, we think, allows us to capture where the innovation is taking place. But that's only half the job, you know, and half the process. The other half is, where is that being undervalued, underestimated by the rest of the investors in the marketplace? You know, so the easy bit is looking at the current share price and saying, what is the market currently thinking about the long-term growth? The hard bit is saying, what do we think it's really going to be? And is there a big gap between the two things?
Right. Now, you know what they say, Raj, the proof is always in the pudding. So maybe as a final question, could you share with us one example of a company that has disrupted the competitive landscape of an industry by applying that disruptive innovation that we spoke about today?
Sure. I mean, I can probably give you a couple of examples because they're very similar to one another. And you often find this, that innovations tend to work really well in one area and can often be replicated in other parts of the world or in other sectors. So if we take e-commerce, you might think, well, that's not very disruptive here, or at least that disruption is quite old. Of course, you know, Amazon was the leader in the world, and then Alibaba in China. But two really interesting companies we think at an early stage of that disruptive process would be companies I mentioned earlier. So Mercado Libre, sometimes called the Amazon of the Amazon. It's the leader in e-commerce in Latin America. And C, which is the leader in e-commerce in Southeast Asia. Now, both are leaders in e-commerce in their respective regions. And with e-commerce, you know, distribution, fulfillment, that confidence that when you order something online, it's going to arrive, you know, when you need it, when you expect it to, is really important. So it's not purely online. So there are real advantages to being a local and a regional player and a leader. But the disruptions, we think going forwards, the powerful value-creating disruptions are really on what I was mentioning earlier, which is the payment systems. They innovated, they copied, you know, the model that Alibaba had to use previously in China of Alipay to make it easier for their customers, many of whom might not have a credit card or may not have a bank account, to use these e-commerce platforms and be able to pay confidently, knowing that they were going to get the goods that they were paying for. These platforms are becoming so popular, they're being used more offline, in shops, in restaurants, than they are even on the e-commerce platforms. And so if I go back to, you know, the success of Alipay, the real benefit came from the fact Chinese state-owned banks were so inefficient. Well, if you look at Southeast Asia, if you look at Latin America, there's a huge potential market out there of people who couldn't even get bank accounts to their local banks, or those who have bank accounts but pay enormous fees for pretty basic services. Mm-hmm. You know, these fintech innovations that were really intended to boost the e-commerce platforms could become the bigger value drivers over and above the e-commerce side in the years to come. So, you know, these are great innovators who have led one innovation on top of another. And that makes it very hard for other players to come in and steal that future growth, that exciting potential long-term growth.
Thank you so much, Reg. It was a pleasure as always.
Thank you very much.
I would like to thank today's guest, Raj Chand, portfolio specialist at Jennison Associates, a fully owned subsidiary of PGIM. This podcast about disruptive innovation is offered to you by PGIM Investments. It was recorded as part of a series dedicated to Fonds Event 2021. For more podcasts, please visit fondsnews.nl/podcast. And if you'd like to know more about secular growth strategies, please check out the PGIM website, pgimfunds.com.
For professional investors only, all investments involve risk, including the possible loss of capital. The views expressed by PGIM is not intended to constitute investment advice, were accurate at the time of recording and are subject to change. References to specific securities and their issuers are for illustrative purposes only and are not intended and should not be interpreted as recommendations to purchase or sell such securities. In the United Kingdom, this financial promotion is issued by PGIM Limited. PGIM Limited is authorized and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority of the United Kingdom with firm reference number 193418. In the European Economic Area, this financial promotion is issued by PGIM Netherlands BV. PGIM Netherlands BV is authorized by the Autoriteit Financiële Markten, AFM, in the Netherlands with registration number 15003620 and operates on the basis of a European passport. Prudential Financial Inc. of the United States is not affiliated in any manner with Prudential PLC incorporated in the United Kingdom, or with Prudential Assurance Company, a subsidiary of M&G PLC incorporated in the United Kingdom.